On the banks of the Red Cedar, there's a school that has a new coach. He will join us shortly. And just how many teams are going to be in the college football playoff once expansion fully becomes a reality? This is the College Game Day Podcast for Wednesday, March 6th. Reese Davis and Pete Thamel. So, Pete, we haven't even played a game in the 12-team playoff era, and already there's talk of 14. And dare I say, whispers that I picked up this week that 16 is already being discussed and bandied about. I know you have ear to the ground on all of these things and the automatic bids, the multiple automatic bids that allegedly the Big Ten and the SEC are seeking in the expanded format. What is the genesis? What is the motivation for not quite being locked in on giving 12 a whirl for a while, which I know we will this year, but I mean for an extended period of time?
Yeah, it is counterintuitive, and this has been pointed out by a lot of people, to finally get a 12-team playoff after endless bickering and administrative inertia and the president's finally doing it, and then throwing the president's threw themselves a parade and patted themselves on the back for getting it done, which is like the most obvious thing in the world. And it's like, everyone's like, these idiots can't do anything. It's 2 years late. And they're like holding themselves up as white knights of the sport. So we finally have a 12-team playoff despite the leadership, not because of it. And we're not even going to like get a feel for what happens in it. And I think that's disappointed a lot of people, Reese. Like, we're not even going to like run through this once. Now, look, there needs to be, there's 2 years left on the deal. So there needs to be a next contract in place. And I understand that. But certainly they are leaving themselves wide open for second guessing to not run through this exercise once to, I think, get a feel for what it's like. But ultimately, the move from 12 to 14 that's being discussed heavily, bandied about, healthily debated in some corners too, stems from really the Big Ten wants automatic qualifiers, right? And Tony Patini in October, Heather Dinich wrote this about a month and a half ago, brought up in the meeting like an expanded, what would an expanded format look like? And this all becomes simple math, Reese. He's got 18 teams, right? I think you can reasonably expect Penn State, Michigan, Ohio State, and then some semblance of Oregon, Washington, USC to be in the playoff conversation most years. And Petiti has made it clear that he equates automatic qualifiers to meaningful postseason games. And meaningful postseason games are equated to television audience viewership and relevant games. Television relevance is what he's looking for with the 18. Now, I think the quizzical look on your face comes from, well, if there's 14, the top 14 get in, won't there be plenty of Big Ten teams?
Yes, you're accurate. And that's been the thing that I haven't quite understood about. Now, let me rephrase. I understand what it is. They're trying to guarantee that they get the shares coming back to their conference, the financial shares coming to their conference. I understand that. My point is that you create this idea that it's not a full open competition because you're having X number of teams from the Big Ten and the SEC or whatever that are guaranteed spots. And you know, look, I've read people who've said they're afraid of competition. No, they're not. They're not. They think they're going to squash all of the competition, but they want to protect themselves from the occasional outlier. I suspect they also want to protect themselves to allow them to expand their conference schedules and then protect themselves when they have a team with three or four losses, but, you know, played a really difficult schedule, still finding their way in. But I think overriding that, in my judgment, unless you can sway me otherwise, is they're going to get that anyway, just on the field of competition. They're going to get that. So I didn't understand why they would throw out something that obviously is going to make the people in the other conferences recoil, unless they want them to recoil so that they can, you know, split off and do their own thing eventually. I mean, you know, a lot of conspiracy working in there and in that theory, but I don't quite see why they need it. I don't see they're going to get it anyway, and probably more than the number of automatic bids that they're seeking.
Yeah. So I'm going to give you the rationale and not the defense in this, okay, in this conversation. So Greg Sankey and the SEC has said aloud multiple times, let's just take the best 12. Let's take the best two. Let's take the best four. Yeah. Like there's a, you know, there's a self-assuredness there that the math would work out for the Southeastern Conference. So Petitti, to understand a little bit of the AQ quest here is to understand Petitti and his background. All right, Tony Petitti is the Big Ten commissioner. He's been the Big Ten commissioner for a little over a year, and he has a strong TV background. He's worked in the NFL. Also, in college, he was part of sort of starting the first BCS. Smart guy, Harvard Law, the whole thing. And he basically sees this number of AQs as assuring that a large swath of his games in November have postseason implications, much like, as Ryan McGee calls it, Sunday football, right? We like Saturday football. We cover Saturday football. We prefer it, obviously. It's where we make our living. Sunday football has wild card implications in the 7-8 team playing the 7-8 team there. And again, this is different because it would be the 7-3 Minnesota playing, you know, Penn State or whatever for, you know, for wild cards. So
trying to, so trying to knock them out, trying to have other teams knock people out of playoffs or get into one themselves.
Giving the regular season, like late game, a ton of juice. Look, they have a bunch of TV partners that have paid a lot of money for their games. And the addition of the four new schools is really going to help the lineups for those, right? Like you're just adding a ton more of value games in there. And I think like the backbone of that, the rationale goes, is that you have a lot of games every week in November that have playoff implications, and there are playoff bids at stake or shots at playoffs at stake. And that is the thought process behind this.
Pete, I'm old enough to remember when they told me that expanding to 12 would make those November games so much more meaningful. So now that's not, it's not just expansion. Now we have to seek this automatic qualifying stuff too. I'm not sure.
What do you think of the buys, Reese?
I'm not a big fan of them. I would prefer that here's what I would prefer, and it's probably not feasible financially. Since we have expanded beyond the very small playoff, I would prefer just going ahead and going to 16, playing the first two rounds on campus and eliminating conference championship games. Now, along with that, each of these mega conferences and the others too, if they wanted to, would play 10 game schedules in conference and then not be required, but strongly encouraged to play another power team from the outside, whether that's, you know, crossover SEC, Big Ten, or ACC, Big 12, or whatever. You can play two if you want to, but definitely play, you know, definitely play at least one of your non-conference games like that. I think it'd be good for television inventory, and it would also create some of these games. I think it would give you more chances to create these games that Tony Petitti would like. And I'm sure, even though Greg Sankey is completely self-assured, and rightfully so, that the SEC is going to be well represented no matter what the number lands on. It would also give a great deal of interest to those games too, and you would have more opportunities to see, you know, Texas against Tennessee or whatever it might be that you might not see if you have a smaller number of games in your conference schedule.
Yeah. The interesting thing, and again, when you start talking about the playoff, you can go down a lot of tributaries of thought, right?
Yeah.
One of them is if the Big Ten goes to 10 league games, which they could, and the SEC goes to 9, which they've talked about ad nauseum and seem to be on the cusp of, those could start to be the pressure points that make it very difficult for Notre Dame to remain an independent because people wouldn't have the room for them on their schedule. That's always been either postseason access or regular season scheduling have always been kind of the things that have, you know, those were the stated impediments for Notre Dame to remain independent. Now, Notre Dame really wants to remain independent. Mm-hmm. If they can no longer schedule or no longer have access to a playoff, that's when they would have to consider, you know, a potential switch. So it would be interesting to see if the Big Ten does that and starts to like cut off some of the air in the scheduling mm-hmm. compartment to Notre Dame.
Well, you know what? See, now you have swayed me a little bit, not about the AQs, but about the expanded schedule, because I'm all for growth, evolution, as the sport needs to do things to grow and to maintain butts in the seats and eyeballs on set. But I'm a traditionalist at heart, and I want Notre Dame to remain independent. I love Notre Dame. I love going there. I like the fact that they sort of march to their own drummer. Yeah. They have their own history that is, while certainly intertwined in moments and matchups with other schools, it is largely their own and not part of, you know, it's not tied in any way to the SEC or the Big Ten or whatever it might be. I like that. So that would be a downside of the scenario that I just laid out. I guess I've always just sort of thought, well, among those one big non-conference games, Notre Dame would play a lot of them, you know, but then that might become something that becomes too much if, you know, Notre Dame, I think in future years, they've got Alabama and Ohio State and Michigan on schedule. You play all of those, you know, the wrong year. And then that's a lot, you know, if you add the others in that they're going to keep along the way with SC and Stanford, I'm sure some of the other ones that they're going to try to keep. I think they're, even with the expanded conference schedules, that there's still enough appeal to playing Notre Dame that they would still be able to fill out their schedule, but it might not be as easy as it is now. So that's a detriment.
Yes. Yes. I would agree with that. And again, we don't have teams we root for. We don't really root for our alma maters. We don't really have leagues we root for, of course, but we like the sport and we like good games, right? I think mm-hmm. that's like a fair baseline. I just wonder if we start going down this tributary that we're going down, where there is more homogeny between these leagues and bigger league schedules. And by the way, I was at a conference in DC this summer, and I believe it was Dean Jordan from Wasserman, longtime TV consultant, made an interesting point. He said leagues getting bigger is no longer going to be more valuable. It's adding league games that's actually going to add significant value, which I thought was a really astute point and is like a pretty good guiding light pushing forward for how these things are going to work. I just wonder if, again, these leagues are big, and like you said, like Tennessee, Texas is really cool, right? Like I can't remember last time Tennessee played Texas. Maybe they did in my lifetime, but that's, you know, there are opportunities within leagues for unique matchups. But I just think the crossover stuff, like I don't want to lose that. Now, again, you have cross country games within leagues, and I get that, but I just think that when you would, the essence of college football is just the different cultures colliding and clashing. And I want Big 12 teams to play Big 10 teams, and I want ACC teams to play. This is agnostic of league. Mm-hmm. I just want interconference matchups between power leagues to continue to thrive. We need comparative data points, if nothing else, and talking about it, Reese, right?
You want Clemson to play Georgia, which they will this year.
Yes.
You want Florida to play Utah, as they did last year. You want Florida to play SC. You know, you want Florida State to play Oregon. You know, sometimes you want games like that. So,
I just think that is one of the things that makes the sport cool, is there's always unique or unusual or rare matchups that make it fun. They're not a league, but like, you know, A&M hosts Notre Dame to open the season. Mm-hmm. I don't know when the last time they played there was, but that's like a once a 50 year kind of thing, right? And it's an event.
Yeah, I remember them playing in a bowl game, like with Leland McElroy leading A&M. But I don't remember off the top of my head the last regular season game that Notre Dame and Texas A&M played. That might be a good place for College Game Day to go.
Do you think so?
I mean, it's certainly got to be right up there.
So I happened to go to the combine this week, and I went to Notre Dame. I did my little Midwest swing while I was there. Went over and saw our friend Coach Cignetti at Indiana, and Riley Leonard, the Notre Dame quarterback, played for Mike Elko at Duke.
So got to get used to that
storylines.
There you go,
right there. A giant collision. Riley Leonard, by the way, delightful kid. He was awesome.
What a good dude he is, right?
Yeah, what
he's a he has a, what a good dude he is.
Yeah, good dude, bright light,
I wish
fun.
Him well.
Yeah, just a really fun conversation. Ben Morrison, by the way, dynamic kid, one of five kids who are college athletes. Dad played in the NFL. Yeah, he even tried to help my sneaker game. And as you know from being around me weekly in the fall, my fashion could use all the upgrade suggestions possible. Ben Morrison's kind of a fashion kid, and was just a. Just fun to talk. It was a really energizing afternoon at Notre Dame, chatting with those guys and just knowing like the faces of the sport in the upcoming years are going to be, you know, dynamic guys like that.
I thought you made quite a bit of progress over the course of the season and the fashion game, the shoe game upgraded, you know.
We tried. Kate Thamel tries hard, man. She tries just hard. She doesn't have much to work with. So
just as long as you don't fall into the trap of the sneakers with the suits.
Oh, like the Jordans, you mean?
Yeah, can't do it, man. Yeah. No one should do it. It should not be done. Should wear grown-up shoes. However, if there are exceptions, you know, some former professional athletes can come closer to pulling it off. I think basketball players.
Yes.
I think basketball players or, you know, football players on the bigger side, you know, have a better chance of pulling it off. However, if you get some really huge linemen who are wearing the suit and then they go sneakers, then they kind of look sloppy. I got to just tell you, they need to wear grown-up shoes. But, you know, if you have the, you know, my former colleague, DeLafonso Ellis, Bill, you know, you're 6'8", you're lean, even though LaFonso never did it to his credit. He always wore grown-up shoes. But, you know, if you're
what
like
Billis?
That,
are you ripping Billis? Because I always see his Pumas under the desk.
Yeah. Yes. He knows better. You know, I mean, that's the thing. That guy's a lawyer. He knows better than to dress like that, yet still every week. But I'll give him this. He does give the shoes away at the conclusion of college game day. And then once again, puts more sneakers on. But the other thing, too, is that Jay's moved away from the suit. And now it's usually just the Peter Millar sport coat and, you know, maybe some type of traveler slack. So he's
a Lulu golfer pant kind of thing.
I think
I don't want to give his brand. He probably has a sponsor, no, so I don't want to give him the wrong brand.
It's Peter Millar. If you've watched Tales from Game Day on there, that's every week is brought to you by Peter Millar. So it's Peter Millar stuff, which is wonderful stuff.
Peter Millar stuff.
I don't have a deal with them. But it's nice stuff. But he's brought it down a little bit. So that doesn't excuse the sneakers in any way, shape, form, or fashion. But
does he need the leg room for 94 feet? Like he needs a little bit of mobility too?
I guess. I don't know. I mean, just, you know, it's not hard. We're grown-ups. Let's wear grown-up shoes. And then when we dress casually, then you can then bring your cool sneaker game. That's awesome. Just not with the suits. Just doesn't look right. Never will. I'll never be convinced. You might sway me on the automatic qualifiers for the college football playoff in a 14 or 16 team field. You might convince me and go, you know what? I've been swayed. I will not be swayed on this. This is an affront to fashion.
So where do you think we end up 2026? What does it look like?
Probably 14 because 16 makes sense. If you're going to go beyond 12, then 16 makes sense. 14 doesn't. I don't even understand 14. You know, what tournament?
This is the understand of 14, Reese. It's pretty simple.
I guess conference tournaments, you could say, well, you know, these 14-team conference basketball tournaments, but it's a weird number.
Yeah, I think 14 with the bye that the SEC and Big Ten are clearly pushing for keeps those conference title games, which are hugely valuable.
That's the thing. Yeah.
I'm not a media consultant.
Yeah.
But it's going to be really hard for media companies to give up conference title games because they're so hugely important. So they're trying to thread the needle here and say, let's expand it with more AQs, but still give our conference title game some juice.
Yeah, and I just, you know, do you think about it, Pete? There have been exceptions, but the only one that's consistently delivered over the years is the SEC. I mean, yes. there have been exceptions here and there with some.
But the Big Ten with no divisions is going to
be a pretty darn good game.
It will be. Yeah. It will be. But the SEC somehow has been able to do it with divisions. I'll never forget this. I've told this story a few times. Philip Fulmer told me once that there was more energy and juice and adrenaline for him personally, and he felt like for his team, anytime they went into the SEC championship game, even more so than when they went in and won the national championship.
Wow.
I mean, he said just the atmosphere. He was talking more atmosphere in the stadium, the intensity of the fans, probably because, you know, easier for those fans to get there. So I understand the value of it, but I just wonder, is that a more valuable commodity? Maybe it is to the conferences individually than having a first round playoff game on campus, because you might wind up with a conference game and the 1-16 game on campus too. And that would be pretty cool. That would be pretty energizing. And one would think pretty valuable, but maybe attaching the word championship as opposed to just playoff and then allowing you to keep all of the money generated from that rather than it going into the entire college football playoff pool. Perhaps that's the one that'll carry the day. And interesting stuff. In 2015, Michigan State made the college football playoff in the four-team field, winning the Big Ten, pulling off a massive upset over Ohio State in Columbus along the way to get there. But the Spartans since then falling on hard times, not immediately since then, as Mark D'Antonio certainly did a wonderful job. But in recent years, Michigan State certainly found its share of struggles. The Mel Tucker era, after a flash in the pan one year, went off the rails last year, and it necessitated another change at Michigan State. And they turned their attention to Jonathan Smith, who they hired, who did a marvelous job at his alma mater at Oregon State. And in fact, if you think back over the history of Oregon State football for many years, Oregon State was a bit of a punchline in college football, with the exception of they have a Heisman Trophy winner and Terry Baker in 1960. And of course, they had some great teams in recent years. And then right around the turn of the century under Dennis Erickson, they were strong as well. And they had a quarterback, a man called Jonathan Smith, during that time that led them to bowl victories, Fiesta Bowl victories over Notre Dame. And really, with the exception of those runs in the 60s, you could probably surmise that Oregon State has been at its best with Jonathan Smith either wearing a helmet or wearing a headset. And he is now the head coach at Michigan State, and certainly they hope that they will enjoy similar type success with Jonathan Smith at the helm. And we're pleased to have him join us now on the College Game Day podcast.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're pleased to be joined by the new head coach at Michigan State, Jonathan Smith. Jonathan, let's talk a little bit about the decision to make this move, a place that had meant so much to you at Oregon State, which in my judgment, maybe outside of the 60s, enjoyed its greatest moments, either with you at quarterback or you as the head coach. What was it like to make that decision to embark on this challenge to coach at Michigan State?
Yeah, not an easy one, not in any stretch. I mean, that place is special to me. Had some great years. I mean, I just think about the people, the university itself, some of my memories as a player, but also as a coach. I mean, the place was great. And so anytime you come across you know, bridges in life. You got to, you know, make some decisions. And this was a tough place to say goodbye to. At the same time, was really excited about kind of the opportunity of Michigan State, the vision, and what this presented, and, you know, on the coaching side. But I thought the fit was there for my family, as you know, the town of East Lansing and all of that. And so had to make the tough call, but definitely excited to be here.
Jonathan, when you looked at Michigan State prior to exploring this job, did you have any context? Had you ever played there? Have you ever recruited near there? Like, was there any sort of local, like, did you have any sort of micro knowledge other than you knew the logo and that Mark D'Antonio's teams led the nation in defense every year?
You know, I did have one experience actually playing here. I was coaching at Boise State, my first game, coaching with Chris Peterson at Boise State. We came over here and got beat. And I still remember the atmosphere of the stadium and the place, and they were pretty good at the time. The natural grass on the field, I still remember that. So that was a little bit of context of, you know, coming over here and experience what it's like for a home game. And outside of that, no, I mean, the national brand, you knew a little bit. They had big time football seasons, you know, basketball, and Coach Izzo, knew a little bit about that. You know, growing up in Los Angeles, knew Magic Johnson, went to school here, that kind of thing. But the only experience really of being at the place and was coaching in that game.
You know, we're going to talk a lot about what to expect with the team and the move and maybe meeting Magic Johnson, meeting Tom Izzo. But as someone who once moved to Michigan with very little cultural knowledge, as I did in 1993 for a little while, I'm turning the camera. Have you done this yet? Have the people showed you this?
Yeah. This, then you point to like where we're at in the state.
Yeah.
All that. Yeah. Yeah. Got Great Lakes around it. And we're about right there. Yeah. I've had a couple people show me that, and I've actually used it one time already.
Did you, Jonathan, did you pick up on that? You're a smarter man than I am. Did you pick up on it immediately?
No, second time I did pick up on it. First time I looked in, I was like, yeah, that makes sense. Then the second time, maybe they explained it a little bit better. Because again, you put your hand up, you got the Great Lakes going around it. It took me a second time.
It probably took me a little bit longer. I was working in television in Flint, which is about 45 minutes to an hour where you are. And, you know, they would say, okay, you're going here to cover, you know, this game, or go meet this coach. And it's here. And they would put up their hand. And after, I don't know, maybe close to a week, I finally said, okay, what's the hand thing? And they said, it's the map of the state of Michigan. I was like, oh, okay. So I figured it out. So you're a smarter man than I am, but that's not exactly breaking news on the podcast, I don't think.
Yeah, well, I don't know about all that.
Reese is modest, but he actually asked, he covered Nick Saban's introductory press conference and raised that very hand with the map on it.
I said, Nick, you're here. No, I'm
Reese obviously spent a lot of time in East Lansing. I've been there over the years, maybe not spent a lot of time. Give us a little bit of, I guess, 3 months in, some of your snapshots. Obviously, you've worked a lot. You're out, not out cavorting, but just give me a college town, local area. What are some of your early impressions? You just closed on a house. Your family's there. Give us a little snapshot of just living there, Jonathan, and what it's been like.
Yeah, well, 3 months, and most of that's been on my own, so I've been able to get around a little bit. Bunch of restaurants, college town, beautiful campus, definitely passionate fan base, and enjoy not just football. I mean, all sports, and we got a bunch of sports doing well with our basketball teams. Hockey just won the conference, gymnastics just won it. So they're passionate about, you know, the athletic programs around here. Welcoming people. I've enjoyed kind of getting around town and meeting people, and a lot of, you know, support, excitement, for what football can be. And you're right. My kids actually started school today. First day of school over there, and early reports over the phone calls that it's gone well. And so going back to the fit, I just enjoyed kind of getting around this town. I think it's a college town, a community that supports each other, and it's a bunch of good people.
Why is that comfortable for you? You've mentioned fit a couple of times with East Lansing. A guy grew up in California, spent so much time in Corvallis and some other cities in the West. Why did you get the feeling that this place was a good fit for you?
Yeah. You know, a lot of times the first thing I think about is, you know, the life work balance in this job. Let's face it, we work some awkward hours, and sometimes they can get long. Really just like even the commute home, you know, how quickly can I when I leave the office, get to the house, or not even just the house sometimes, whatever activities are going on locally, school, sports, that kind of thing. East Lansing provided that in regards to location, how far you're working from home. I have blue collar mentality, working for things. Feel like Michigan State's been a place that, you know, put in work. We earn things and go about it that way. And I feel that I value that kind of thing. And but that was another fit for me.
So there was a mention of Magic Johnson. I know you're a passionate Dodgers fan. I assume growing up in Pasadena, you're a passionate Lakers fan.
Yep, sure was, man.
How many balls growing up did you throw away in the stands trying to mimic Magic Johnson on the court when you were in your junior high?
I tell you, man. Yeah, growing up, now I was young at the time. This guy's playing whatever in the 80s, and I was born in 79. But so, you know, those later years of watching him and Abdul-Jabbar and James Worthy transitions into obviously Kobe and Shaq and the whole thing. So I have born and raised LA sports teams, Dodgers. Shoot, I just went over spring training last week. We had spring break. So it was awesome. Went to Arizona for spring training. Well, it just happens the Lakers are playing the Suns. So I was able to catch the Lakers-Suns game. And then Dodgers, Shohei's first game out with the Dodgers, goes yard, his third at bat. And so still following pretty close.
The Dodgers just, they buy all of the players. They've got the highest payroll in the history of mankind for any endeavor. They need a player, they buy him. Freddie Freeman, Mookie Betts, Shohei. Have you used the Dodgers and their payroll as an example to your collective and NIL people at Michigan State?
I haven't used the Dodgers specifically, but let's face it, this landscape, you got to be able to be competitive in that side of opportunities for your players on and off the field. And again, you know, being a Dodger fan, like if you got the resource to do it, go and chase championships that way. And I think we got a chance this year with that top of the lineup, like you mentioned.
You think?
Yeah. We'll find out how it goes.
What kind of seats did Matt Ishbia get you for that game? And did you have to root for the Suns because the billionaire Michigan State owner is one of the biggest donors to your school?
Right. Yeah. I don't know if I'm letting, he had great seats for me and we had an awesome time, got on the court before and all that. And I told the kids too, we're going to root for both sides. The Suns ended up winning the game. And so we didn't come out any type of Laker gear sitting with his crew.
he's a good dude, by the way, a former walk-on basketball player, as most people know, at Michigan State. And the basketball coach there at Michigan State is a football nut, Jonathan. Yeah. Have you how much time? Because he's been in the middle of his deal right now. Mm-hmm. They've had some ups and downs. What have the interactions with Tom Izzo been like so far?
Yeah, pretty consistent. He has been great from the start, even arriving here, coming over to the office. We've hung out both sides. I've been to his office a couple of times, trading text messages. There's no question he's a huge football fan, telling the story all the way back to Steve Mariucci, you know, when Coach Saban was here, still really close friends. And it's been awesome to have a guy that, you know, knows this place inside and out, to just be someone to lean on, gain information, experience from, supporter. He told me he's missed like four games in 30 years, football-wise. He does a great job, too, connecting with our football players he's got relationships with. So he's been a huge, huge asset for me here for the first 3 months.
Well, we know with Coach Izzo what the identity of his teams are going to be. He's established that very quickly. I think folks who followed your teams at Oregon State would have a pretty good sense of identity and in what they are. How much of that transfers over the pro style, kind of, you know, little smash mouth, but also, you know, the pro pass game and everything, Jonathan? What identity can you set in year one at Michigan State? Obviously, you haven't started spring ball yet, so you're still working on it. But what do you hope that your identity is in year one at Michigan State?
Yeah, no question. We want to make the game physical on both sides of the, you know, line of scrimmage. It starts in a physical run game offensively that you can build some pro concepts and play action game and things. And that, going back to the fit, you know, Reese, you were talking about, I felt like schematically Michigan State could fit a style that I've been around. And that's on both sides now. And we're defensively, we want to make the thing physical and challenging. And so we're going to try to implement that from day one. Again, this conference, the competition, it's going to be heavy hitting. And I'm just excited about that new adventure on the league. I think that brand of football wins, especially I think about the weather come November in this conference. And so that's some of the logic of trying to keep that from previous stops.
What have you seen in off-season workouts so far in terms of what the roster looks like? You did a really remarkable job in a short period of time cobbling together the recruiting class and putting it in much better shape than it was prior to your arrival. So how do you assess the talent and how that would relate to what your expectations are for the first season?
You know, early impressions, first few months, I've appreciated the effort these guys have put forth, starts in the weight room, but even the buy-in. And, you know, obviously things are different, right? You got different mm-hmm. coaches, you're going to have different schemes, you got different ways of working out in the weight room and the buy-in there. These guys are putting in a ton of work. Definitely anxious to see them on the day-to-day spring practice to go to work and see what kind of skill set we're working with and things. I'm optimistic on what we've got. We've got some younger players that have played. We've got some veteran players that chose to stay and be a part of this thing with some additions. You're right. Got the job into November. And there's a lot going on in that month of December, but felt really good with our additions, freshmen, high school players, and from the portal. And so we'll kind of see what it looks like come spring. And make some adjustments in the summer to make sure we're working toward our best skill sets and strengths. But I'm also optimistic with these guys' work ethic and the talent we've got that we can be pretty competitive.
Well, Jonathan, I remember talking to you last summer. You obviously had a returning starter at quarterback. You had DJ Uiagalelei. You had, you know, guys who won a lot of football games in college, and you kept saying, Aiden Childs, Pete, Don't be surprised if he's competing for snaps. Don't be surprised if he earns playing time. Like, he's got it. He's special. He's very young, I want to say, you know, going in as a 17-year-old to college. He obviously earned real snaps with you at Oregon State and then transferred to Michigan State. Give people who may not have seen him a snapshot of his skill set and what you hope to see from him this year.
Yeah, I think he's got a lot. And, you know, I think it starts with his instincts. Playing that position, he is just instinctive in recognizing what's going on, timing of routes, timing of movement in the pocket, when to take off and run, when to hang in there. He's just instinctive playing the quarterback position. Definitely has some arm talent and can be really accurate, strong arm, can do that. But athletic, of extending the play when he needs to. Smart, works at the game, picks up schemes pretty well for, again, he was 17 when he arrived last year. He's still 18. He'll turn 19 late September. Wow. And so he's got a lot to him. Comes from a great background. You know, obviously getting to know the family really well through the recruiting process and the support of elite mom and dad and helping him mature and grow. And so we're really fortunate. Then, you know, he's with us and going to work. I appreciate even being here at Michigan State the last couple of months. He's not trying to be the face of the program from the get-go. Just going to work with the guys, throwing extra. So excited to kind of continue to see his progression.
Has he taken that leadership reign? It's hard to do, I think, and you would know this better than I have, and coaches, it's hard to do until you play. If you don't have the big reputation coming in, you know, a Caleb Williams or something, if you transfer in, might be different. But if you're transferring in, you're coming with the coach, you know the system, but you haven't played with the guys. How has he established at least some level of leadership to give him a chance, assuming that he wins the starting quarterback job, to be the leader on the field of this team?
You know, I think he's been able to take advantage of it because he does know the scheme. He knows what the terminology is to then be able to bleed that to the guys around him and help those guys out. And that turns into a leadership role. And I don't think he's trying to take it too far. We've got some guys that have been around this building 3-4 years that have, you know, earned the right to have some serious influence in the building. So he's not trying to be the leader, but I think he's leading in a great way because of the experience he has and comfort level in the offense.
You hadn't spent much time in the Midwest, Jonathan, and you also have a core of staff who've been with you for a very long time. And so there was obviously a threading of the needle that had to happen where you want to keep your core people who've been on your staff, but at the same time, you need people who can recruit that Midwest footprint. So you bring Brian Lindgren with you. You you obviously hired Joe Rossi from Minnesota, who'd been in the Big Ten. He'd been at Rutgers and in a few other places. Walk me through how you feel like that staff has shaken together now that you've had a few months with those guys.
Yeah, kind of a lot of what you said. There's some core guys that have been with me for a long time that we're coming, a part of establishing culture, deep-rooted trust, elite coaches, elite people. But it did not feel like it was the best move to be able to transplant entire building from one side of the country to the other. And so wanted to have some experience and, experience in the league, recruiting ties to the area. And so I feel like we've done a good job. You mentioned Joe Rossi, Chad Wild had been at Indiana and Minnesota before and had some deep ties coaching in the Big Ten. Thought it was important also if there's former players that could, had experience place as a player. And now we're coaching. We got two of those with Courtney Hawkins, the receiver coach, big time player, had been here on staff the last 4 years, able to keep him wanting to be a part of this thing. And then Demetrius Martin, who had known really well, competed against at a high level, played here back in the day. And so we got two Spartan dogs that are on staff. So I feel pretty good about the blend. I've got a good core of guys that have been with me, and then some guys with deep Big Ten ties. Former players, and it goes into the support staff as well. I mean, these staffs are getting bigger and bigger, which is great. But a lot of core guys with me on the off field side, but at the same time, some people that know the area really well.
I had a really, I don't want to out him because it was a private conversation in a lot of ways, but it was a high level coach who said, "I'm not really sure what all of these people we have on staff do." all of these analysts, what's the optimum number? What's overkill, or what do you need in your judgment to make sure that you're competing with the upper echelon teams in the Big Ten?
Yeah, I don't know the number. I'm kind of with you, especially early on. What's the responsibility? What are the roles? What are the everyone's supposed to be doing? Spelling that out. I will say it does take more than, in my mind, now just 10 full-time coaches. I mean, you need some resource around competitive edges are gained by having some more people, whether we're talking schematics football-wise, in the weight room, office, at the recruiting side. So there's a lot of roles that can take place. It does feel like it gets pretty big. But I think if you do a good job of defining what everyone's roles are, I that puts me at ease. Seeing a lot of people helping out.
We had who came on the podcast the other day,
or it may have been a Q&A that I did. Somebody said
Matt Rhule, Jed Fish.
Matt Rhule did come on. It was Jed Fish, but Mike Elko actually said this to me in his office when I was there for the title game.
Just here to try to spark the memory, Pete.
Appreciate it. I need it all. There's a lot of dead air in there, as my wife can attest to. So Elko is basically like, it was pure chaos the first couple weeks I was here. You got half the team in the portal. You got to hire a staff. You basically went fairly quick from your regular season ending to that job. Walk us through the chaos of learning a new place, pulling guys out of the portal, having to make all these decisions that probably aren't that informed, right? Like, it's not like you got to sit there and watch 4 hours of a guy's film at right guard and decide whether you want him or not. Just walk me through some of the dynamics of the chaos of those first couple of weeks, Jonathan.
Yeah, a lot going on because it did, you got the job, just finished the season. Just even the emotional ride of that, making the hard decision, saying goodbye to a roster, a community that you care deeply about, that wasn't easy. Transition over here 48 hours later. And then, it was dead for 4 days before the portal opens. So you're trying to dive into the current roster, spell out a vision, opportunity. But those guys, some of them, we had guys in the portal already. And then we had some guys that are still making decisions. So there was a lot. I did feel like a little benefit that we brought over some of these core guys that we knew were going to come. And so I wasn't just on my own. From, we had some coaches with us, we had, chief of staff with us, a general manager with us, strength coach with us. So that was somewhat helpful. And it wasn't just about your current roster, obviously trying to recruit. So you're trying to learn your current roster, hold on to the guys on your roster, at the same time trying to recruit. Signing dates coming up, and it was like 3 weeks. And so even identifying needs that you wanted to sign, you had to learn about your current roster and who was staying. There was a lot going on that end. So we tried to, you know, spell out the vision of how we want to do things. And that got a decent amount of guys that were in the portal that wanted to buy in and come on back. That was huge. Same time, then you're trying to sign a high school class, which I'm still a believer. I still want to fill, can't say 100%, but a good amount of your locker room with guys that come in as high school players and develop, get better year in and year out. But just in this day and age, that's not the only way you can build a roster now. So, yeah, getting into the portal, and we'd like some of our additions really on both sides of the ball, and let the dust settle here January, February, March, learn about it. And then the portal's going to open again the end of April, and we'll see what that looks like. I do feel like that at that point, feel way better than the month of December.
How do you describe, and I mean, I guess we've sort of touched on this in a couple of different ways when talking about your move. From a head coaching standpoint, what is the appeal of coaching in the Big Ten?
Well, I think, again, the history, tradition, and really trajectory of where college football is headed, you know, you want to be a part of that. You know, there's big-time players, coaches, tradition, the additions of the four schools coming in. I don't know if there's a better conference in the country competing against that week in and week out. That was exciting to me, you know, taking a shot at doing that.
When you're coming into a place that has that giant shadow south there, now they're coming off, now they're in transition too, but they're coming off winning a national championship. You know a lot about that from your time at Oregon State. What can help you be successful at Michigan State when you have that sort of a behemoth sitting down there that Michigan State's had a great deal of success against in, say, the last 20 years or so, particularly under Mark D'Antonio. But historically, it's been Michigan and Michigan State trying to catch up. What will help you have success the way that Spartan fans hope that they'll have against the Maize and Blue?
Yeah, a couple ways I think about that. I do look at the history in Michigan State, especially over the last decade and a half of being really competitive, winning a bunch of those matchups. That was something that was intriguing to me. It's been done here before. These guys have played in college football playoff and beat the rival multiple times. And then I look at it again, going back to the Big Ten question, I just think about Big Ten and what championships can be won in this conference. And, you know, the two, I know UW in the Pac-12, but it's coming over. The two that are playing for the national championship are in the conference moving forward. And so that excites me. I'm not saying here to say anything's easy. I mean, we got some work to do and all that. But it's been proven that you can do it here. I feel like the resources, the commitment is here, the leadership, starting with Alan Haller and the AD, the vision of what that aligned with where we want to head. And now we're ready to take it all on.
Talked a little bit about your offense. And obviously your hand is in there more as a former quarterback and an offensive coach, quarterback coach and a coordinator. On defense, again, it's early. You haven't seen these guys in pads yet. Keeping Derek Harmon on your defensive line was seemingly one of the bigger, amid that portal chaos, one of the bigger moves. Give us a little sense of him, and maybe is he an identity builder on your defense, Jonathan?
Yeah, I feel really good about him being on this roster and staying here. You know, coming from the city of Detroit, multi-year player and a really physical, you can watch it on tape, a physical good player. Got into the portal in December, which I understood. I did say that in regards to these guys been through a lot and, you know, exploring their options. This guy had some big time options to go consider out there in college football. And so giving us a little bit of time of getting to know him, what was a priority to him. I think there was a fit in regards to how we wanted to build a program, go to work, the schematics mattered. And so that was a process of weeks for him to decide. He chose to come back, and he has been great in regards to, I think he's got influence in that locker room, his story, being local from this state, being able to continue and finish, graduate as a Spartan is something we're really excited about.
I'm going to follow up there, Reese. The program obviously went through a pretty good amount of tumult last season, and we don't need to certainly go over the details of that. But just you bring structure, a little bit more continuity, and a more clear vision, which just wasn't there because of the leadership situation with the interim coach, et cetera. Have guys craved that? Have you felt they've responded to you as a leader and just wanted some stability there, Jonathan?
I feel like that, you know, I do that. They wanted structure. They wanted the teamwork and the circumstances, what they were under last fall. I actually was somewhat impressed watching them on tape. I know they didn't win as many games as they wanted, but they continued through all that distraction that was going on. They were still competitive. They played tough later in games, found ways to win at the end of the games. I mean, they won four. I thought they had a chance to win six or seven with all that distraction going on. So I actually thought there was some competitive character here. And going back to the ability to keep a lot of these guys adds to my optimism that, you know, we can do some stuff.
When you set your foundation, your core, what are your non-negotiables for your team?
A lot of times you talk about trust. We're trying to build some trust, not just connecting, knowing each other, but also being trusted, right? You can show up on time and go to work and you can trust what you say. And so that's a foundational piece that, you know, we want to be about. We do talk about too, the star of the team is the team and having a mindset that way in this ultimate, I think, team game that football is. Even in this transactional environment and, you know, on and off the field, it's not all about my touches or my stats or my making plays. It's about the team, trying to instill that in regards to, you know, sometimes if I play defense, I need to be in the B gap so that my buddy can make the play. I'm doing my part for the team. And so the star of the team is the team.
One of the things that in the conversations that Reese and I are having about the new CFP in this new era where you have an 18-team league. Nobody's had an 18-team league before. You have a 16-team SEC. I believe we have a 17-team ACC. I probably need to bone up better. Math was not a strong point. But it's just looking at your schedule, Jonathan, you see a stretch of Ohio State at home, at Oregon, Iowa at home, at Michigan. Is basically like a month of games. And it's like, well, you want to be in a super conference, here you are, laid out in front of you. I'm just curious, when you glance at that, what do you think that's going to be like? Because it's just different.
Yep. I think it goes to like what you signed up for. That's right in the middle of the season. I think we play four before that stretch of four games, and then you got to finish with four. It's kind of what you want to do. I'm definitely glad we got some time till we get there, right? Mm-hmm. You can get to the spring ball and see that. But I'm excited about, again, this level of competition, experience in new places. I know Autzen won't be new, but some of these other stadiums and environments and all of that. And this is what we wanted to take on, this challenge and all of that. I'm glad we got a great crew, coaches, players that bought into that thought and put in some work. So those games can be ready to go.
They'll have a warm welcome from you there, I'm sure, like they always did.
Oh, I'm sure they'll be delighted to see you again. I'm sure. Maybe you can remind them of that whipping you put on them year before last. I'm sure they'll be delighted to hear about that. A couple of quick ones before we go. I want to harken back to your playing days for a second. What's the best catch ever made that you've seen, practice or game, of a ball that you threw and who made it?
Oh, interesting. Okay, I remember we're at Arizona. This is 2000. We're running double slant concept. Well, Chad Johnson, Ocho Cinco's on the outside. I threw a ball so far behind him that literally he goes back and catches the thing. His feet are higher than his hands the way he catches it. That was dynamic, just his athleticism of catching that ball. And he reminded me how bad a throw that was for
multiple times. When did you start calling him Ocho Cinco? Or do you still just call him Chad?
Yeah, well, I didn't know what the best way. I mean, he was Chad Johnson, then he changes his thing up. I'll tell you, he is a beautiful now. And he's done well post-career. He had a great NFL career, and now he continues to do well.
How about the pronunciation of Hushmanzada? How long did that take you? Were you good there?
That took a while. Yes, I remember
You have anybody on the Michigan State team that rivals that you're having to learn right now that rivals Hushmanzada?
You know what? Not that one. That thing was hard. That's why it was as simple as TJ. And that's
and then the last one I have here, I think that you're now at a school that has perhaps the most underrated fight song in all of college football. Are you learning the words and banks of the Red Cedar, school that's known to all, specialty is winning. Because originally they said the Farmers play good ball. Now they say the Spartans play good ball.
Spartans ball. Well, I'm learning the history on that. That's definitely on my list that I got to tighten up. And hopefully we'll be singing that thing a bunch after wins. But I do not know it or the history of it yet enough.
The one thing, there are a couple of fight songs, and I'm a nerd. I mean, I fully admit this about all things college football. That fight song and the Aggie War Hymn will get in my brain, and I'll just randomly blurt it out in the middle of the house for days after I've done a game or been to one of those places. So,
it's easy to remember. So I'll be able to pick it up. Okay,
you'll pick it right up, and you'll love it. Hey, Jonathan, man, we've for a long time admired your work at Oregon State. Rising star in this industry, and I know you're going to have great success there in East Lansing. So thanks for spending some time with us, and we wish you the best of luck.
Well, I appreciate you guys. Yeah, anytime, and enjoy what you guys do for the game itself as well.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Jonathan Smith, what an easygoing guy, Pete. And I really found it fascinating to talk about finding that fit, because I think a lot of coaches don't recognize that, because they think, well, I'm a really good coach, I'm going to fit. And a lot of times that is true. He seems to be very cognizant of that, but in terms of fitting his style of play, as you look at their roster, and you mentioned Aiden Childs, you know, they've had quarterback problems there, or at least last year they did. So what do you?
No, it's been longer than last year.
Yeah. Okay. It's been, you know,
it's Kirk Cousins basically.
Yeah. Peyton Thorne had.
Yeah,
some
Peyton Thorne's all right.
Peyton Thorne had some moments there, but when you look at them, what do they need? What's something they need the most in order to have a successful first season under Jonathan Smith?
Well, the offensive line was a mess, and the entire line was in the portal when Smith basically got there. So I'm a big believer, Reese. I've said this in the pod before. You can't microwave an offensive line, right? Mm-hmm. Look at Colorado last year. They brought in all these guys. Doesn't mean it's going to work right away. It takes time. Right. It takes synchronization. And I think it takes growing up together, and you've got to be old. So I would think for that identity that they had at Oregon State, he mentioned willingly smash mouth physical. I think they need to build into that. And I think the line is the first place. Look, there'll be some familiar names on offense. TJ Sheffield, who was at Purdue for about 11 seasons, has one more season of eligibility, his sixth. He's going to be there at Michigan State this year. And if you go through who they've picked up in the portal, they brought a tight end in from Oregon State, no lineman from Oregon State. They only took three guys compared to, I was just at Indiana, they took 10 guys from JMU. So I do think this is, if you looked at his year by year at Oregon State, they did not start out bonkers out of the mm-hmm. gate. It was very much a slow build in every way. 2-10, 5-7. They were 2-5, and then COVID, and then 7-6, 10-3, 8-4. So mm-hmm. He built a program, and I think it was a really smart hire for Michigan State, because that's what they're bringing him in to do. Michigan State needs to be a developmental program. That's why they were at their best in the last 50 years under Mark D'Antonio. And that is what Jonathan Smith has proven he can do at a very high level at Oregon State.
It's really something that people don't like to hear, especially if you're fans of the school. And this is not a criticism, though it is going to sound like one. They're never going to be Michigan. They're never going to be Ohio State. That doesn't mean they can't beat them from time to time. It doesn't mean they can't get on good runs against them, as D'Antonio did, particularly against Michigan more so than Ohio State, but they had some moments against the Buckeyes as well. So they have a guy. Yeah, exactly. I mean, so they have a guy now who understands that mentality. Now, I don't know if he will have the same chippiness about it than D'Antonio did, who detested every wretched breath that Michigan sucked into their greedy lungs, you know, and that played very well on the banks of the Red Cedar. but the just the way that he builds his programs, the patience that it's going to take, the lumps that you're going to have to endure, not only at the start, but maybe periodically, you know, as this goes along, sort of fits with Michigan State. But what you want is a certain level of consistency so that when you do jump up and make the playoff, you do jump up and win the Big Ten, maybe when you do it 2 years, that when you fall back, that you're falling back to 8 wins, that you're not falling back to 4 wins. You know, and I think that they've got a guy who is perfectly suited to be able to do that, to have them cycle up, be contenders for a couple of years, hopefully make the playoff, maybe do well in the playoff. But they're not going to constantly reload talent the way Ohio State and Michigan are capable of doing.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
I think it's very fair. I'm excited to see this build around Aiden Chiles. If anyone, Michigan State fans are listening and they want to go down a YouTube rabbit hole, Aiden Chiles threw a ball 60 yards in the air against Arizona this year. I mean, it was just an uncorked monster. And like, again, talk about arm talent, flashes. The ball was complete too, by the way. That's an important part of that. You know, saw Joe Milton at the combine. You know, there needs to be some touch involved. But he's, you know, there were special flashes with Aiden Chiles as a very, very young player. So you've got now 3 years of him as your identity, a building point to focus on. I just think that was such a huge get for Jonathan Smith, because you don't have to teach him the system. He can help teach others the system, and you can kind of grow and move from there. Just block also, for him.
It's also going to take a little bit of getting used to, because I immediately went to the they're not Ohio State, they're not Michigan. The question is, are they Oregon and Washington?
Yeah.
You know, because they're probably not USC either in terms of stockpiling talent, but they might be able to be, you know, along the lines of Oregon and Washington. We'll see about Penn State. But, you know, they're going to be right on the cusp in terms of recruiting classes most years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, good year, they're going to be upper middle class, you know, but yeah, most of the time right around the middle would be my guess, because that's the way mm-hmm. it's kind of always been, right? I mean, yeah,
and retention through NIL is going to be key for them. Their NIL is generally perceived to be well supported. Now, it was a bit of a mess at the end under Tucker, and I believe it's been cleaned up and it's going to be a lot better pushing forward. But Michigan State has resources, you know, like there's no one's blinking at that notion. They have right. well-heeled alumni. They are motivated to win. They have won recently. So I really think in a lot of ways, it's a good spot for Jonathan Smith to go, you know, bloom where he's now planted.
We mentioned during the conversation with Jonathan too, Matt Ishbia, who the former walk-on, who's been wildly successful in business and has been extraordinarily generous, not just to the basketball program, but to the university at large and to the football program. Now, you know, He's also needing to take care of the Phoenix Suns. So, you know, there's probably not an endless supply there, but he has certainly spearheaded a lot of generosity in that program. And they also have a lot of alums from my experience with them who are very loyal and proud to have gone to school and played at Michigan State. So that that bodes well. So I'm told by Adrian and Sean, our producers, that they believe game day has been to Michigan State 9 times historically. There are some unfortunate things that have happened at Michigan State prior to my arrival there. Let's just say that I believe that maybe a trip to Michigan State is one of the reasons that we now have a net behind the set. But guarding the set, the guy missed. His arm wasn't good enough to hit anybody. So, but he missed. And it was. I think it was tossed in fun. I'm pretty sure that was Michigan State. Anyway.
Can I ask what was tossed?
Yes, it was a beer, and it was not during the show, and it was prior to my arrival. I was just in studio, and it whizzed in there, and I think they said it hit on the set and exploded and whatever. I don't even think it was thrown in anger. It was thrown to, hey, let's see if we can get this beer to explode on TV. I think, as I recall, I don't, you know, which is not a good thing, but that probably means that a number of the beers had been consumed prior to throwing the full one. But
Michigan State is known for that. It's a
consumption-based student body, you know.
And if, by the way, if I have the school wrong, my apologies. That part's neither here nor there. This is the better story. Well, first of all, when do you think How long until we get game day back to Michigan State again?
I think we'll be there in the next 3 years.
Next 3 years. Fair enough. And if we have indeed been there 9 times, I believe this would have been our most recent visit for that game that they won against Harbaugh's Big Ten champion and playoff team. And what that would have been 2021, the first one, mm-hmm. I think. Yeah, I think that was the first. I think it was the first one, not the 22 team. Yeah, that's right. The only loss that they had prior to the playoff. So they win the game, or they eventually won the game. So they were really fever pitch. And we had the celebrity guest picker there, who was the great Ken Jeong, the comedian, actor. He was there. And
big energy.
Big energy. And we're on the field because it's a noon kickoff. And so I want to tell this story because it's one of the funniest things that's happened since I've been on College Game Day, but I'm very hesitant. As it turns out, Ken was saluting his wife and picking a UCLA game because his wife is an alumnus of UCLA. His wife is also a doctor. The lovely Tran Jeong, who prior to marrying Ken, her surname was Ho. And Ken Jeong said, "You complete me," and then referred to his wife's surname prior to their marriage. And we were not aware of this. I think Herb Street was in such dire straits about this sentence having been uttered on game day that he lost it and didn't hear Ken say, "Oh, settle down, ESPN. That's her name."
Went to UCLA Med School. Shout out, Tran. You complete me, Ho. That's her last name. That's her last name. Relax, ESPN. How dare you?
He might be my favorite celebrity guest picker because, I mean,
really?
You do not know what's going to happen when Ken shows up. You know, he's a wonderful guy, too, by the way. Just a sensational guy. And when that light comes on, some magic is going to happen, but you don't know where it's headed.
And he made Sims seem low energy this year at Duke. Like she's like a wallflower compared to him.
When he came on at the end of the show at Duke, he crawled on the ground and started like, I'm not really sure what he was doing. I think he was kissing or licking the cameras. I don't know what he was doing, but it was hysterical. Anyway, I hope to see him this weekend because he often is at the Carolina Duke game at Cameron.
Oh, cool.
Because he's massive Duke fan. So
big Duke.
But anyway, that's a great moment that Michigan State will try to top. They hope at some point when College Game Day returns to the banks of the Red Cedar. Can you sing a few bars of the fight song
for Michigan? I know zero words, but I am not a fight song guy like you.
Really? Why not? I mean, how?
I couldn't even sing Syracuse's fight song. Really? I was the beat writer for a long time and like sat there and listened to it all. Yeah. It's part of my boring persona. I'm focused on inane other things.
So nothing gets in. Like if you go to an SC game, you don't like stroll around the house for days after going dun 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 dun.
No, maybe like if I'm filing a story that night, it might like be echoing in my head a little bit. But by the next day, my brain's filled with so much other dead matter that, like, you know, it's they don't stick around.
So the words hullabaloo, connect, connect, hullabaloo, connect, connect, that they mean nothing to you?
Zero.
Started the Aggie War hymn.
Oh.
Yeah. So interesting. I bet Mike Elko knows that now.
Yeah, he's smart enough to learn the hymn.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he was there 4 years too, so.
Oh, that's fair. He doesn't have the same steep learning curve that Jonathan Smith has at Michigan State with learning, but plenty of good Spartans fight green and white ready to help him out there. So that was fun talking to Jonathan. Great to catch up, Pete. Good playoff talk as well. We appreciate you listening to the College Game Day podcast. We encourage you to subscribe or download your podcast wherever you prefer to get them. Most of all, we'd like for you to watch us on YouTube because we actually dress up for this, sort of. Pete wears his best hoodie. We'll see you next time.